in pottery, very few people get close to perfect. In life, very few people will get really close to perfect. So why worry? Just have fun with the turkey.
This is Daring to Tell, the podcast where writers read their true stories of personal daring and where we talk about writing and life. I am Michelle Rado.
Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave. Nothing's gonna make me brave except doing what makes me scared.
First, some business. Making note of a tiny change you may have noticed. If you happen to follow this podcast, meaning you get it on the day that I push it out into this big bad world, then you may realize it is Thursday. I always have put my episodes out on Tuesdays. I decided to change it to Thursdays. Maybe you've not hit that little follow button in your podcast app, but once you do, it's like magic, once a month, these writer memoir book conversations will automatically pop into your listening queue, and you hopefully won't have to go searching for it or miss anything I put out ever again. Ha ha. And thank you if you've already done that. I so appreciate each and every person who has discovered this podcast and sticks around for more. I will say getting the word out about it is a slow game, but heck, I am a slow person, so it's probably a good match. Moving on, I have a little bit of a funny story to get us going for this month's episode. I used to work with a woman whose name was Cynthia Goodenough. Though she always went by Sin Goodenough, a name that I always thought sounded like it belonged in a morality play. But I also thought it was kind of sad. Good enough. Sin was a very self-effacing woman, a solid character, and when I first met her when I first started working at the radio station as an intern in the summer of 1987. I got a tour around the station, and I remember seeing her sitting at her desk, smoking a cigarette. Yes, in the days when people smoked in the office. And as I got to know her more, I always found everything about her to be more and more interesting. She was the only person I ever knew who had a personal shopper. She was always impeccably dressed. She had very close-cropped hair. She wore gorgeous dangly earrings and always had a very warm and welcoming smile on her face. She walked to work every day. Her job was a copy editor for the station's member magazine, back when public radio stations actually had member magazines. And she also told me that if she was ever out and about at some other gathering or met someone, and they would say to her, "Oh, where do you work?" she never wanted to say the rather famous call letters of our station. So instead of telling them that she worked at a radio station, she would say that she was a clerk in a small insurance agency. Oh, Sin. She was very clever and never wanting to draw attention to herself. And I could go on with many other Sin stories, but I will not. Because my point, as I ramble on here, is good enough. In a funny way, good enough has always been something that I say. I have said in my career, sometimes even in my life, especially working at a radio station where the clock is the thing that rules everything. So yes, you do the best you can for the thing that's due tomorrow, but with other things due after that and after that, you learn to prioritize and to make do and to make things good enough. All of this has led me to never really feel I was a perfectionist or had perfectionistic tendencies. However, the rigors of a broadcast day is one thing, the creative process, something else entirely. What does rule when a clock is no longer paramount? In a creative endeavor, like writing a book and especially a memoir, There are endless criteria to parse and only our own rules to make about what we have to say, how we approach the work, and knowing when it's done. There is a writer I've been working alongside with, I might say, for quite a few years now. She was in a writing retreat I attended in the fall of 2021 and then popped up in a few classes we both attended through the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance, a truly wonderful resource for workshops and retreats and connecting writers and publishers here in Maine. Hearing her work at various stages through the years has quite literally made me both laugh and cry. So when I heard her book was finished and out in the world, I jumped at the chance to read it cover to cover. I was immediately drawn to her theme, the Japanese philosophy of wabi-sabi, and how she applied that to her love and practice of pottery. I had already been interested in wabi-sabi and had also tried my own hand at pottery, so it's about those things, but so much more, and told with her self-effacing, spare voice and wry, quiet sense of humor that really comes away with a very powerful effect. So today, I would like to introduce you to writer Nancy Collins, and we will discuss her book, The Perfectly Imperfect Potter. So welcome to Daring to Tell.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just thinking about, I was thinking about the classes that we took together. That was in 2021. And when did you start working on this book?
Well, it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
When I think I started. I started working with Rick Weil, and he was doing a lot of writing on his own and helping other people. And then he decided one day that he would have a little group at the Episcopal Church that he was at. I was not at it, but he was at the Episcopal Church, and he thought it would be really nice to have a little 3 afternoons of just doing some writing. And they were like a couple weeks apart. So a friend of mine asked me if I wanted to come. And she wasn't Episcopalian either. So I think she was looking for somebody like me to go with her.
Yeah.
But so this little group started. There were about maybe 7 of us. And I didn't know if I'd even like doing this.
Yeah.
But anyway, I tried it. And I loved it. Mm. So after 3 weeks, we all said, we can't stop now. You need to keep giving us lessons for a while. So that has been going on for 10 years.
Wow.
And so now once a month, this group gets together and we share things that we've written.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because over 7 years, some of these older people are gone. They have died. Some new people have come in. Others have left. We have a woman now who is almost 100.
Wow.
And she has just finished her book and is looking for someone to publish her. And we're hoping it will happen real fast.
Yeah.
So
right.
But that, which kind of made me think, after I've been sitting here for 10 years working on this book, I better just stop just in case I end up like her. I have several decades more than she has to do, but still.
I was going to say, I think you've got some time ahead of you to work on promoting it now, which is the next heavy lift of the job. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I am now. It's like, okay, I'm done with working with it. Now I want to share it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So 10 years-ish, and you were with this writing group, but you also, so you were taking these classes that we have been in together. And I feel like from what I've heard, as you've read through the classes and, and places, and we also both attend Nina Lichtenstein's literary salon, and I've heard you read there. And so I feel like you have been, might I say, single-minded in the project that you're working on. Because when I first met you, you were working on something called the Wabi-Sabi Potter. Mm-hmm. And you've landed on the perfectly imperfect potter, and it's about pottery, and it's about life, and it's about Maine, and it's about so many things that all really fit together quite well, but like seeing little pieces of it as we've, you know, met in these places here and there, it also seems quite unified. So what has the writing journey been like for you? Have you felt like it's a single story you needed to tell? Have you gotten different prompts along the way? Like, what was the core of it? And are there other parts that just naturally didn't fit in? Or was there a lot of editing that really you like threw tons of stuff away you loved? I don't know, anything like that.
Well, I've gone to a lot of workshops, mostly from Maine writers.
Yeah, MWPA. Yeah.
So Rick, who I keep talking about, decided that, I was really a serious writer. So most of the people in the group, he thought, they're not really very serious. But he could tell that I was a serious writer. So, and plus, I think he was getting tired of me. So,
well, I was going to say, did that assessment resonate with you?
Yes. And I was like, I wanted to go further with writing. And I had not ever taken an English class or except for, you know, the one you have to in high school. And then I was always able to get out of taking English classes. And Rick thought that I should take some more classes. So I started doing classes, and then I did the weekend workshops. And so I really kind of made a challenge out of learning how to be a better writer.
Yeah.
One thing that I think is different is that when I was about halfway through writing, I discovered wabi-sabi. Mm. And wabi-sabi is about imperfection, impermanence, and incompletion. So I started, I changed everything. So I started writing, you know, 1 week or 1 month, it would be about imperfection. The next one would be about incompletion. And then another one would be about impermanence. So there were a few years in there that I was just juggling all three of those. And the people in my writing group were having to juggle along with me. And then finally I said, I think that's just too much. And really what interested me the most was the imperfection. It was really sad to throw away, and I did throw away pages and pages of everything else. And so I really, really started moving in to that one piece of the product.
Yeah, like that one theme was the one that you felt spoke to you the most.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think that's interesting because in the book, it's always very streamlined. And I love seeing how and what writers have done in order get to what seems like a very obvious and very, you know, well-structured, well-themed story. So it's interesting about those other facets. Yeah, because when I met you, wabi-sabi was kind of the focus. Mm-hmm. And when you were saying that, I lit up in our class because I went, oh, I just had heard about it. So I guess there was a time when, what, maybe in the early 2000s or maybe before that, was that when you were noticing wabi-sabi or when it came across your consciousness?
It did. And there was a certain date, but yeah.
Yeah.
That's in my book, but I can't remember the exact date.
I can't either. And I always come to things very late, so it might have been far before it reached me anyways. Yeah. But
and it was also, it came from the Japanese. And then in England, it became popular.
Oh.
And then it came to America.
I didn't know the England part. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, in Japan, it's been decades, maybe centuries even.
Right.
We're a little slow.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
The association from Japan was the one that I had known. And I found a book about it. So I also liked the imperfection part of it was really interesting. And so my first big question is regarding the book, like, what is the role of perfection in your life, maybe as your starting point for the book that you've written?
Well, I think perfection was from my childhood. My parents always expected for me to get a straight A in school. And if I had a chore to do, I was expected to actually do it. So it was really about trying to be perfect.
Yeah.
And so that's really, you know, the whole first half of most of my life, of always trying to be an A student, always trying to be the best in anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are things I'm not good at, I avoid them.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting, because so this book is really about you try so many things. So that yes. is one very mm-hmm. impressive thing that sticks out a lot to me. So do you want to just introduce us to where we begin in this book? Because it's a very interesting starting point. You're sort of midlife-ish, might I say? Young midlife-ish?
Yes. I was 39 when I got my divorce. And it was from my second husband. He divorced me. He found another woman. And so I was really in a mess. He spent a lot of money, and he often didn't work. And so it was really a terrible relationship at that point. So when he said, oh, I found someone else, I cried for a day. And then I said, you know what? I'm better off.
Mm.
I knew we would not be able to keep the house.
Yeah.
It was like a big, expensive house we couldn't afford. And so we sold the house.
Yeah.
So at that point, I had to find a place to live. Well, I really didn't want to live in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't done that, you know, since early college days. So I said, you know what? I really want to just live on a boat. And we had a boat, but that boat we couldn't afford. So that went away. So I found a boat, bought a boat, and moved aboard.
I mean, that's a really interesting starting point. I just love that you started on a boat.
Yes.
So what was life on a boat like? Because it's tiny to start.
It is, although the boat was not a particularly small boat, but I loved it. I loved it even when it was rainy or when it was snowing or when it was, you know, in the middle of summer. It had an air conditioner and a heater on it. So it was very comfortable inside the boat because I had a wonderful view,
mm-hmm.
mostly of other boats.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time I had two cats and they were funny and fun. They went all over the marina.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, because I was the only woman at the marina living alone and and I had two cats, which nobody else had. So everybody knew me or knew of me. And so it was a very friendly place. We had a place to eat. And so it was fun.
Yeah.
I loved it.
And it was what you needed at that point. You know, it seemed mm-hmm. to really fit you because, I mean, I can't imagine living on a boat in a marina. You talk about rain and snow mm-hmm. and all the weather that you were dealing with. And so let's also say where you were. You were in Virginia, right? This was
Virginia, yes.
Not Maine. We'll just say that much.
Exactly. It was not Maine. Occasionally somebody in Maine will stay year round on a boat, but only people if they're really crazy.
No.
But it's very difficult. It's hard with the ice on the water. So it was about the farthest north you could live year round on a boat. Well, you could live year-round on your boat in Florida if you wanted to. But if you go much higher than a little bit into Maryland, but really Virginia Beach section was the furthest north you would want to live.
Yeah. Well, in your story that you had of the snowstorm that you weathered through was quite harrowing. And the part that I think I would have maybe the hardest time dealing with is that you like went into the boathouse to shower every day. Your bathroom mm-hmm. was small. And so, yeah. But there's also something so cozy and compact and nurturing, I think, about a boat, which I can see how it might have really been a good nest for you at that point.
Yeah, because one of the nice things is that I didn't have to clean the bathroom.
Oh, yeah, right. Exactly.
That's true. Marina took care of that.
And did the cats have a litter box there? They did, right?
Yes. There was a little litter box for them on the boat, but they also, because they were outdoors a lot, they had their own little place in the sand.
Yeah, because if they go in and out, they can do both. But I know, yes. I think it was in your book where you said, even though they go outside, they still come inside to use the bathroom, which is
a little annoying.
So during this time, you also were really actively engaged in a whole bunch of physical activities. Like you joined, was it a singles group where you would go and meet various people and they'd have outings and you'd do all kinds of things like that? And you have a chapter where you talk about athlete or artist. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes that I love in this book is your openness to try a whole bunch of things, mm-hmm. but this sort of meandering way towards, you know, actually, I don't really care for that so much, but I prefer that other thing. So, and because what I wanted to do is share one of the moments. This is one of my favorite lines. If you don't mind me reading.
Not at all.
You, back to you. There are many like little chuckle aloud moments in this book. So you were talking about, yeah, the single society and playing tennis and doing all these various things. But you had a background in interior design and you really loved sewing. So that's something else that we have learned up to this point about you. And you say, the part of me that made drapes and rearranged furniture felt like the real me. Of course, I did not share that with anyone. One never says, "Hi, my name is Nancy. I'm very creative and I like to sew curtains." There was something about that line, Nancy, that I said, yeah, like finding out the things that we know about ourselves when it's not maybe the classic, like, I do the things everybody does, the creative side of you. Mm-hmm. I loved seeing that. And I love the voice of the book. So working our way towards what I was going to have you read today has to do with getting into the pottery a little bit. And so there are two things we need to know. And one is Jack. Do you want to introduce us to meeting Jack?
Right. So I met Jack during the time that I was living on the boat. And I was free, other than the cats, but I could kind of do whatever I wanted to. But I also wanted to, you know, make friends. And, you know, in the marina, there were plenty of men, quite a few men that were, well, not particularly nice men, in that they had wives, but they thought, you know, that I was a little more special, you know, so there were some, you know, kind of issues to avoid. So really, basically, avoid your neighbors in that regard. But, you know, after a few years of living on a boat, I was interested in getting married again, or at least having a serious boyfriend.
Yeah.
So that's when I started looking around, went to a, they were the singles group that did skiing. So it's like a skiing singles group.
Oh, right, right. Yep.
And so that was everybody, you know, including people with kids.
Oh, okay.
So I joined this group just to find people to go skiing with, and then keeping my eyes open to see if there were any single men that would be interesting. And that's when I met Jack. Well, when I met him, I actually didn't actually meet him. I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked across the room. But I didn't go very close, but I just wanted to look at him. And he had these beautiful blue eyes. And all of my husbands have had blue eyes. So I was kind of drawn to this good looking guy with blue eyes. But he was sitting down. I didn't know how tall he was or anything. And he was sitting with two women, but he wasn't, you know, sitting like he was real close with them. So I thought, nah, he's probably one of the singles people. And of course, all the women will look for all the good-looking men and so forth. But I didn't go talk to him or anything. Like, it's too nervous to do that. And you don't just walk up to a guy who has two women with him. But it really was interesting to me. But I left. So a month later, the single society skiing event occurred. And I saw him as I walked into the room of the skiers. And I just thought, I'm going to just go talk to him. So I did.
Mm-hmm.
Then shortly after, I discovered that he wasn't a skier. And I was determined to find somebody who liked to ski, but he didn't ski.
Yeah.
But he had the beautiful blue eyes, and so that was enough.
And another side plot there was he was a carpenter, and you really had quite a few repairs on your boat that you needed.
Yes. Yes. By then, I had been on the boat for a few years. And
so logistically, it worked out well, but there was certainly that attraction. So you and Jack did hit it off, and so he becomes part of your story fairly early on, as does the pottery, which you discover through Elaine, who was the pottery teacher. Oh, no, it was a drumming circle first. So
yes,
in the drumming circle, which you were like, I don't know, which was another, I could tell a drumming circle story myself, but I won't diverge at the moment, but yes. Yeah, so pottery, how did you...
And yeah, Elaine helped me with the pottery. She had her own pottery studio and was giving lessons to people. And so I joined that group. And then she decided not to do it anymore. So I went to the big art studio in Virginia Beach and took lessons there. And then later when we moved to the Virginia Eastern Shore, I moved to another pottery place, a smaller one.
Right.
Yeah. So I went with three different people over the years.
Right. So it was something that really resonated with you, obviously. Like, yes. What was the feeling when you first started touching clay?
I fell in love with it immediately.
Yeah.
It was almost like making cookies.
Yeah.
And like when you bake cookies, like the kind that you put in little balls and put them in the oven.
Yeah.
And I liked artsy things.
Yeah.
You know, like putting a cherry on top kind of stuff. So that's what I liked. And I also, much as I loved the arts, couldn't draw very well. Never been good at drawing. You know, some people can draw beautiful pictures of people. I can't. If I draw a picture of a person, you're not sure if that's actually the same person. I'm just not good in that. But with pottery, you don't have to be that perfect.
Right.
So then it became fun.
I love that. I love that, actually, that once you realized it didn't have to be perfect is when it became fun. Again, another theme. So would you like to read for us at this point? I think that I'm trying to think if there's everything else. So we do have a reference a little bit to the wabi-sabi that will come in, but we've gotten folks up to speed on that. The other thing I meant to say was that silence became a big part of your story too when you decided to go on some meditation retreats that were just silent. And so that's just another facet that, you know, that you had woven into the story was the pursuing of silence. And it gave you, I think, space in your head to allow things to absorb or percolate or settle. I don't know. So at this point, perfection is still a theme in your story. And you can, if you would like, I would love to have you read this chapter called Jack's Pottery. And you can begin whenever you're ready.
Okay. So chapter 14, Jack's Pottery. Living the so-called perfect life kept getting harder as my life kept getting busier. I worried about helping my mother, who lived so far away. I felt like my job was neglected when I went to retreats on the other side of the country. The graduate program I wanted to finish was dragging. Then, of course, there was the cat and the husband who needed their shares of pampering. Even my relaxing pottery class, A 45-minute drive each way once a week in the evening added to my stress. I decided that living the perfect life was not what it was cracked up to be. At least one thing in my life must be just for fun. Still, I kept on trying to keep my perfect life perfect. Then good luck arrived. I learned that the pottery studio would be moving to a new and better location. This studio would be 30 miles closer to our home. My current teacher, Elizabeth, was coming with us. Pottery would now be my sanctuary from the busy life. The newly renovated 1920s historic Onancock School would become the new location for the local arts community. The building contained studio space for numerous artists, including a large classroom just for pottery. I could not wait till Elizabeth moved into her studio. The day the pottery space finally opened, I was there. I saw it was a very different studio from any of the three places I had worked in before. This unpretentious studio reminded me of the relaxed atmosphere of Elaine's old garage where I took my first pottery lessons. However, this studio was much bigger than a garage. The new space seemed far less intimidating and much smaller than the strict and orderly pottery studio back in the big art center in Virginia Beach. This new studio looked larger than Elizabeth's tiny crowded studio 45 minutes away. However, the historic school pottery studio in one way looked quite different from all the others. The new pottery studio was a gigantic mess. Pottery studios are hard to keep clean with all the dust and mud and glazes. Still, potters are expected to put everything away and to wipe off counters and tables, but not in this studio. When Jack saw it, he compared the appearance of the historic school studio to a teenager's messy bedroom. I compared it to the cab of Jack's pickup truck, where he stashed his power tools, paint rags, old newspapers, and empty coffee cups. We both agreed Elizabeth's studio could use some straightening, but we did not discuss Jack's messy truck. The work tables in the studio held a mixture of half-finished projects, some waiting to dry, some only partially painted. Tools took up much of the surface. Partial bags of clay stuck out from under the tables, along with jars of dried-up pottery glazes. Wooden chairs, some with broken legs, scattered the room. Window sills were lined with dead plants no one remembered to water. The kiln sat in the corner by the window, so hopefully the exhaust would go outside. Of the two pottery wheels, only one worked. The overhead fluorescent lights flickered on their last legs. Unusual music, like songs by Moravian musician Eva Batova, played on the stereo. The coffee pot always remained on. The coffee mugs rarely looked clean. Obviously, no one seemed to care about the mess. Meanwhile, Jack fixed the fluorescent lights because they drove him crazy, too. Everyone but me appeared to be used to it. I did my best to tidy it up without being too obvious. Mostly, I just dealt with it. Elizabeth and I became good friends, and I never wanted to hurt her feelings. Periodically, Jack drank coffee and hung out with Elizabeth while I worked in the clay trying to make perfect pots. I kept trying to talk Jack into taking pottery lessons, but he said no, he'd rather just socialize. Elizabeth became more like our younger sister than just a friend. Her string of failed lesbian relationships seemed to always be full of drama. More than once, she had tried suicide, so we treated her gently. Jack especially loved giving Elizabeth advice, which she ignored. One day, Elizabeth talked Jack into joining a beginner pottery class, and he said yes. He told me later, I just could not say no to her. I stopped at the pottery studio on my way home from work to see how Jack's first lesson had gone. The ladies in the class were walking out the door as I came in. They did not notice me as they laughed and talked among themselves. I wondered if they were talking about Jack. Meanwhile, he sat at the work table near the door with his hands covered in mud and his eyes admiring his new creation. A big smirk lit up his face when he saw me. Look, I'm a potter. Elizabeth sat next to him. Isn't Jack terrific? He is so talented. In the first lesson, Elizabeth had taught her friends, five older ladies and Jack, how to make olive trays. Jack showed no interest in creating an olive tray. Years later, he admitted he did not know what an olive tree was supposed to look like. Instead, Jack made what he called a cat in a basket. As I admired Jack's cat in a basket, he beamed as though pottery came just naturally to him. Jack acted so cocky, I worried that Elizabeth had created a monster. I picked up Jack's cat in a basket and turned it around. The coiled clay basket looked rustic. The cat looked a little primitive. At first, I found it kind of silly looking, like something a child might make. But the more I gazed at it, the more I started seeing all the freedom of expression, the fearlessness of someone who had created something for the pure joy of it. I felt more than just a bit jealous of Jack's cat in a basket. He had created a charming, authentic, simple piece with character. Its simplicity washed over me, making me think about my own pots and how hard I worked to make them all look the same. I kept asking myself, what is wrong with me? I could not get Jack's clay cat out of my mind. 3 days later, while I was waiting in line at the grocery store, I mindlessly picked up a magazine from the rack and brought it home. I sat in the living room that evening and flipped through the now defunct Martha Stewart magazine called Whole Living, the October 2010 version. In case you're wondering, it was after she got out of jail. I spotted an article titled Wabi Sabi Life. The photographs grabbed my attention. The magazine did not show the usual huge mansions with manicured lawns designed to create envy. Instead, the pages showed pictures of simple objects, misshaped organic vegetables, patched linen fabric, and cracked clay bowls. These objects were labeled as Wabi Sabi. Each one looked far from perfect, yet at the same time, each looked beautiful in its own way. They reminded me of Jack's simple clay basket with a silly cat sticking its head out. Jack had unknowingly made Wabi Sabi pottery. I let the magazine drop to the floor. It stunned me. Why did I not know about this aesthetic philosophy of imperfection called Wabi Sabi? Or in simple words, it is okay to be average. I had unwittingly discovered what I had subconsciously always wanted, permission to be imperfect. Jack's clay cat haunted me for days until I finally sat down in front of it and analyzed it. Could it be just beginner's luck? What made such a simple piece of pottery so appealing to me? Then it struck me. Its appeal seemed largely because of its simplicity. It started becoming clear to me that my approach to pottery might be all wrong. I had spent years in art studios trying to throw perfectly round pots, and admittedly, perfectly boring ones, to look just like everyone else's perfectly boring pots. I became so used to trying to make perfect pieces, I forgot to create items that can be simple, original, and fun. Except for one piece. I remembered the funky turkey with fat legs I had made as a beginning potter in Elaine's garage studio. I had made that piece just for the fun of it. I kept it because it looked so silly. I took my little ceramic turkey out every year for a few days as a comical Thanksgiving decoration. I had to admit, the turkey did look more interesting than many of my other pottery pieces. I started thinking that I should reconsider my relationship with the turkey and with clay, and of course, with perfectionism.
Ah, I love this so much. I'm going to pause to just like breathe with what you just shared with us. There's so much here to love. Okay, one question I have for you has to do with that little tug of envy when you saw Jack's cat. Mm-hmm. What does that envy do? Like, why do we have it? That's my deal. What is that about?
I think we compare ourselves to other people, and particularly, you know, like with Jack, who can do things that I can't do. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a little competition between spouses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, I always felt like, well, I can paint better than you can. Like, I always paint the house or whatever we're doing that requires painting. So I kind of consider myself in this marriage as the artist.
Mm.
But Jack is the one who can, you know, fix the car, build the house, be very athletic. So all those things. So I think it was just a little bit of competition.
Yeah. And because it is something in that territory that we recognize as our own, like, wait, I'm supposed to be good at this. I'm the potter. Like, you wanted him to take the classes, and then he has this thing, and you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
So what I'm always interested in is the places where our outward attention goes that tells us more about ourself that we might not have necessarily recognized to begin with.
Yeah, it's one of those things you think about later.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And another one is this theme of simplicity. And what I wrote a little note in my book at the end of this chapter is simple is rarely easy. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
With pottery, it is never simple. You think it is simple. And sometimes you make like a little pinch pot and you say, oh, that is so simple. And then it turns out that piece, well, it was kind of lopsided. It didn't really look all that good. And then there'll be another piece that you think, well, that's just junk, but I might as well go ahead and finish it. And then that's the one that turns out to be the good one.
Yeah. So you mentioned about this little turkey because you're striving for perfection with your pots. But tell us about the turkey, because the cover of your book is this turkey. So tell us about making the turkey.
So the turkey is probably the worst looking piece I've ever made. It was done when I first started doing pottery. And one day it was just before Thanksgiving, and we decided that we should make turkeys. Well, turkeys, it turns out, are very difficult to do in pottery. Because my first thought was, yeah, turkey, that's easy. Anybody can do that. Well, the problem is, and you pretty much can, until you get to the feet. And the problem is their legs are skinny. And so immediately the turkey flops. And so you had to make the legs thick enough to keep the turkey from falling. So by then I was starting to get frustrated because this darn turkey kept going flat. So finally I said, I'm just going to put these big legs on it and forget it. So I did. And then we painted it and then put it in the kiln for the last piece. And it came out, I thought it looked pretty good, except for the legs that looked so stupid. So I didn't really want anyone to see it, but I thought, well, it's kind of cute. So for Thanksgiving, I will put it on the table. Well, after I did it, I just threw it in with the Christmas decorations after Christmas. And the next year, there's that turkey again. And then after the years now, I love my little turkey. I love my turkey so much to put it on the book. And also to say it's imperfection.
Yeah.
And in pottery, very few people get close to perfect. In life, very few people will get really close to perfect. Yeah. So why worry? Just have fun with the turkey.
Exactly.
So that's what I did.
I love this turkey, by the way. It is so cute. And I would not call it ugly at all. And I like the legs. I mean, yeah, there's also a practicality to pottery, which is another reason why I wanted to do it, because it's a useful thing. Like, so I'm showing Nancy, this is my first pot.
I like it. I like the color.
Thank you. I wanted to have something with fun color, and it's probably, I don't know, 2 pounds. It's really heavy. Yeah. Because I thought it was going to be a thin bowl, but it's not. It's a big clunky pot.
No. Yeah. I think everyone should try pottery.
It's not anything that you expect. And that is another thing that is wonderful about the many explorations that you have that bring you to places you didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
So your next chapter in the book is called, it actually begins part 2, where you accept imperfection. And we're going to skip over the wabi-sabi And folks can get your book if they are curious about that, because that's also a very good chapter. But I wanted to get to Maine for obvious reasons.
Okay.
We're going to jump a little ahead to chapter 16 whenever you are ready.
Okay. So chapter 16, Restless Again. My dreams of Martha Stewart, Buddhism, and wabi-sabi pottery were keeping me awake at night. My little world on this narrow peninsula between the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean started feeling increasingly tiny. I felt the need to expand my horizons beyond the small surroundings of Deep Creek. I pulled myself out of bed, threw on some clothes, and went for a half-hour walk around the neighborhood. I strolled to the end of the street of 9 houses, 4 on the left, 5 on the right. I stood at the edge of the calm water and looked across to the other side of the creek leading into the bay. Then I turned and walked back to the other end of the cul-de-sac, passing our house on the left and the marina boatyard at the far end. From there, I walked out onto a short pier and looked at the water from the other direction. Nothing had changed. Even the laughing gulls still looked just like the ones flying around from yesterday. While standing on the pier, I took a deep breath. Then I realized my problem. I had been waking up to the same exact scene and walking that very short road for over 10 years. I loved our house on the Virginia Eastern Shore and our tiny town of Deep Creek with its almost 100 people, but 10 years in the same place felt too long for me. I was tired of the same view, even though it was a great view. I liked my job very much and enjoyed my students, but it had become kind of repetitious. I loved my pottery lessons and my friends, but I did not like the hot weather that seemed to get longer and hotter every year. I felt too lethargic to even get out our wine-making equipment and return to our former hobby. I sensed that Jack, whose wanderlust was similar to mine, might feel some of the same restlessness coming on. I did not say anything to him, but I knew too much grass had begun to grow under my feet and maybe under his. On the next ungodly hot Saturday afternoon, when the outdoor weather must have been at least 108 degrees, I felt too lethargic to clean the house or even run the vacuum cleaner. Even with the air conditioner on full blast, I could not move. Finally, I just flopped down on the second floor living room couch and stared into space. As I lay there, I heard a siren calling to me, "It is time to move away from this heat." Then she lured me on with, "This is not the way life should be." About then, the front door opened and footsteps came up the steps to the living room. Jack, with Bruce, the cat, tagging along behind him, was unusually silent. They had been outside in the sweltering garden together. Heat radiated from their bodies as they sprawled on the hardwood floor. The air in the living room smelled sour from Jack's sweat. The brutal heat and humidity were more than even our 5,000 BTU air conditioner could handle. Just looking at Jack and Bruce made me feel miserable. I sat down on the floor next to Bruce and petted him gently. Then I turned to Jack and sighed. "Jack, what would you think of moving to Alaska?" He did not hesitate. "Sounds great. This heat is miserable. It's going to get over 110 degrees today. I would be more than happy to live in an igloo. How about you, Bruce?" "I'm serious, Jack. Virginia is too hot. Let's move north, but maybe not as far as Alaska." We both recognized that we were running into our retirement years and it was decision time. Jack had lived in some appealing places like Monterey and Bermuda. I had particularly enjoyed Boston as well as Maine. We had many options, but the decision seemed easy. Jack smiled and said one word, "Maine." I answered with one word, "Maine." Jack knew how much I loved the state of Maine. Fortunately, he had vacationed at Bar Harbor with me and had enjoyed it as much as I had. On that hot southern day when our clothes stuck to our bodies and people and animals felt cranky, Maine seemed to be pulling at me. She called me again with the state's slogan, "The way life should be." While sitting quietly for a few minutes and letting the idea of moving soak in, I closed my eyes and envisioned Rockland, Maine. Then I retold my stories of living in Maine to Jack, who had heard them many times. When my family moved, I was in high school just as I started 10th grade. My father got offered a new job in Rockland, Maine. My mother was a little skeptical of moving from the Midwest to a small coastal town in New England. When I learned that Rockland was on the ocean, I was ecstatic. At that time, I loved the Beach Boys, especially Brian Wilson with his Surfin' Safari. I imagine the Beach Boys did shows on the beaches in Rockland, just like the ones they did on the California beaches. After all, an ocean was an ocean on either side of the continent. We moved to Rockland in early October and bought a small single-story home in a housing development near the high school. I knew we had moved to the most perfect location on earth, except for one little glitch. Rockland beaches are not exactly like the long, sandy California beaches shown on television. But I soon decided that sunbathing on the sand in California could never compare with walking in the length of the breakwater that jetted out a mile to the Rockland Lighthouse. Nothing could be better than sitting on the rocks or running the nearly 1 mile length of the breakwater and dipping my feet into the frigid bay. I could still hear the foghorn from the lighthouse in the harbor. I recall the simplicity of sitting for hours on the pebble beach, sniffing the salt air and listening to the waves lapping the shore. I also remembered my father teaching us how to cook lobsters and how to drench them in butter for dinner on Friday nights. We also found that no people could be nicer than Mainers when they wanted to be. We were surprised when our next-door neighbor never spoke to us. She did not even wave to us from our front yard or from her car. Mother just shrugged her shoulders and said, "I think New Englanders might just be kind of standoffish at first." Then, 6 months later, on a lovely spring day, our neighbor walked over to our house carrying a beautiful red velvet cake with white frosting and red sprinkles. She handed it to my mother and said, "Welcome to the neighborhood." Mother invited her in, and they began to chat. Before the afternoon ended, they had become best friends. Our neighbor, Jean, soon started baking birthday cakes and surprise cupcakes for everyone in our family. The two women shared coffee together every couple of days. I kept asking Mother, "Why didn't Jean talk to you before?" She always answered, "I don't know. I guess she will tell me if she wants me to know." Then one day I overheard our next-door neighbor say, "Do you know why I never talked to you until spring?" Mother's response was very casual. "No, why?" "Because I did not know if you would make it through a Maine winter. I did not want to waste time making a friend who would just up and leave because it got too cold." I realized then that Mainers are extraordinarily smart. They do not mess around. Jack and Bruce were still lying on the floor and halfway listening to my pontification. Then Jack sat up and turned to me and said, "Let's go." "Jack, do you really mean it?" He turned to Bruce, then back to me. "Bruce and I are ready to go." Jack and I started chanting, "We are going to Maine. Bruce, we are going to Maine." Bruce silently slunk away and flopped down on the cool tile of the bathroom floor, almost as though he did not want to be seen with us. With Jack's back and shoulder injuries from his years as a carpenter, he had already retired from heavy work. It made sense for him to move. However, I would have to find a job in Maine before moving. It did not need to be a big job. It felt like time for my career to start winding down anyway. Of course, we would be leaving behind good friends and our beautiful house with its view of the Chesapeake Bay. We felt especially proud of having designed and built our home. We loved its magnificent view. But when we started talking about where we wanted to retire, we realized we did not want to spend the rest of our lives in rural Virginia. Of course, no place would be perfect, but a cooler place would definitely be nice. We did not want rural, and we could not stand heat and humidity. We thought about where we would want to live in Maine. I did not really want to go back to Rockland, even though it was a great small town. What if I ran into an old high school friend and my age showed? I did not want my old friends to see how old I had gotten. I felt sure they all looked as beautiful as they had in their teens. We would want to be near a hospital. One late afternoon a couple of years before, I had smashed my hand while pulling our sailboat into a dock. When we got to our rural hospital, we discovered there were no surgeons on duty on Friday evenings. I had to be emergency transported to a hospital across the bay. Fortunately, they got to my hand on time and saved it. Since then, I have wanted to live fairly near a hospital. Jack and I thought about moving to Portland, Maine. However, a city might be too busy for us and also more expensive. A town somewhere on the coast halfway between Rockland and Portland would be perfect. Of course, there must be a nearby place where I could take pottery lessons. That did not mean that my town and my pottery studio had to be perfect. They could be wabi-sabi imperfect. In other words, they should be just fine. Not wanting to take any chances, I made airplane reservations immediately. What if they ran out of houses in Maine before we got there? A week later, we flew into Portland, rented a car, and drove up the coast. We made an appointment with a realtor to look at houses in the mid-coast part of the state. I told him I would prefer an old New England-style house. I also said I didn't mind if it needed fixing up. The realtor said he would show us a 90-year-old house in the coastal college town of Brunswick. He described the house as being a short walking distance to downtown and a 3-mile bike ride to the bay. He explained that this house just happened to come with an attached pottery studio. I could not believe my ears. A pottery studio? My own pottery studio in my own house? It sounded perfect. Even better than perfect. It could be a dream come true to have my own studio. I never, ever thought that could happen. It felt like a gift from above. Then our realtor warned us that our potential new home might be a little different. I knew it was always a bad omen when a realtor described a house as different.
Dun, da, dun. That's and that's where we're going to leave it, because, again, Nancy, you say so much with so few words, and that is a real gift. Is that just how you write? Is that how you are? Like, I'm just curious about your style. Your voice is just so beautiful.
I think it really helped over the last 10 years to read in front of other people, and more important, in reading what other people are saying.
Yeah.
And that way I can see where some people will just keep rambling on and I don't have much attention. And so I really learned how to get the story moving before people fall asleep. So I think that was the big thing I learned over the years.
That's a very good lesson. I love that. Well, it's wonderful. It's wonderful, wonderful. It has a simplicity that I know was not easy, but feels like a unique pot intentionally formed and not perfect, but you know, and I think that to me is one of the biggest underlying messages of this book and in so many books that I love, that it's like, how can we come to the thing that is most us and stop trying to make it perfect? Mm-hmm. How do you feel now that your book is out?
I'm still feeling like it's not really true. I mean, it's not really happening. Yeah. It's not really happening.
Yeah.
Because after 10 years, I just stopped. I said I could keep writing forever. And so to me, it's important to at some point just say, okay, stop. It's not going to get any better. It might even be worse. So,
Which is, I think, another important artistic question. It's like, when are we done with our thing? You know?
Yeah.
Our story is as much guided by when it is as much as what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I learned in writing groups is it's best to not start with when you're a small child.
Right, right.
Especially if you're going to end up, I mean, if you were 20, that would be fine. But if you were closer to my age, then it could be a huge book. And then I think the reader gets a little tired.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what I focus on. Is that I love humor. I talk in humor all the time. It's sort of natural to me. And so I've tried to avoid rambling.
You definitely don't. You cut to the chase. Mm-hmm. You do. And it's refreshing as a rambler. Sometimes, you know, I recognize that. And in my own writing, I feel like I have as many parenthetical comments as mm-hmm. I do other, you know, like my actual point. And I read something the other night for Nina's Salon this past week. And I think that the timing container, you know, like if there's only 5 minutes to read, you can only have so many indulgences and diversions, but you got to stick to your point. So, yeah, it came across very well. And I've loved seeing you work on it along the way. So congratulations.
Thank you. I have to say that Nina's Salon has been a big help because she forces you to cut your piece short.
Yep.
So I would cut my piece short to make her happy. But then when I came home, I said, you know, I think this is better than what I had written in that chapter. I'm going to go back and condense it.
Yeah.
Because you can just, when you condense, it really gets people interested.
Yeah, I agree. I've had, you know, a few things where I've done where word counts are feel like a curse. But when you really wrestle with it and say, all right, I'm going to get this down to 500 words or whatever it is, it forces you to think about it in a different way and to be more succinct. And I agree with you that most of the time it ends up being a better piece because of that. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. My final question I always ask mm-hmm. everyone is the daring one. What was most daring about this book for you?
So I think what was most daring was what if I failed?
Mm.
What if I failed? Because I managed to do well in school.
Yeah.
My mother was a math teacher. My father, my sister were engineers. So everything was supposed to be perfect. So I'm really, it's my fear of failure, I guess, to make it simple. So it was like, okay, what if I write this book, but only a handful of people read it? What if no one liked the book? Which I think I think that most people would feel that way. It's like, maybe it's not good enough. Maybe I should have done this. Maybe I should have done that. But I also have friends who have written books and they think that every single thing they have written is perfect. And I read their book and I think, they could have left that out. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's the, I think, you know, it is the perfection and imperfection and the ability to just say, you know what, I'm just not all that perfect and then stop.
Right. So that struggle with perfection sounds like continues for you, but you're wrestling that one down a bit more as you go too.
Yeah. It's part of life, I think.
Yeah. Just to think about the failing thing.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, I think to what the definition of failure is, and you listed mm-hmm. a couple of them, is always the interesting question. And it's so hard. I think another whole facet as we suggested, I can't remember if we talked about it before we started recording or not, but the whole second phase of promoting one's book is a whole other thing. So
yeah.
I know you have a whole new project ahead of you.
Yes.
But I think that the do people really like it? That's the one that, again, like the part of what you say that speaks to me is I hope the people who do read it do appreciate it. And I, for one, want to say how much I really appreciate it. So I hope that it reaches the right readers who are also going to find a really beautiful, compelling, page-turning story about imperfection and creativity and like moving towards oneself, because mm-hmm. that is, that's a story that I can't get enough of and that I look for in many, many of the books I read. And that was what I absolutely loved about The Perfectly Imperfect Potter.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. Well, I will say thank you so much for talking with me. And I will see you at the next salon, I hope, yeah?
Oh, yes. Once you start writing, you can't stop.
Oh, I loved that little final comment from Nancy. Once you start writing, you can't stop. That's actually a bit of a question that has kind of been so far in the background, I haven't really thought of it until this moment. But as I continue working on a sort of endless process of a manuscript for myself, what will I do when it's done? Is that something that keeps me procrastinating, doing every other project before my own writing? It's not the only reason, but indeed, I think it's one of them. I think it's more fun to have a process than to be finished with one. I do think a completed project comes with satisfaction, but the question of, okay, now what, is the anticipatory one that perhaps harkens back to the ongoing nature of my time in the world of radio. Always another broadcast day is ahead. Considering it all through a wabi-sabi lens, there's that other facet of it that Nancy mentioned that she chose not to focus on, but is indeed part of it, impermanence. And as I open up my own little book I bought a few years back entitled Wabi Sabi, it says, relating to the acceptance of the transience of all things. I think the idea that's resonating with me at the moment is that one of impermanence and also silence. Another theme we didn't quite get into so much, but I am digging into these days. Silence is the negative space that permeates our stories and our lives. Perhaps I will have more for you on that at some point. I will let it float for now, but I will wrap up this episode to say that there will be a link in the show notes for Nancy Collins's book, The Perfectly Imperfect Potter, as well as for her website. She is also going to be making her way around Maine in the month of October, doing a few readings. And I know she has also offered one of her pots, along with the purchase of a book, at some of the readings she's done so far. Perhaps she has more and will be doing that again. But if you'd like to check her out in October, she'll be at the Wyndham Fall Harvest Festival on Saturday the 4th. She'll be at the Rockland Sunday Stroll on the 19th, and then at Curtis Memorial Library in Brunswick on Monday evening the 20th. So if you are in Maine, these are some great chances to connect with her and get the book in person, maybe even one of her pots to boot. Maybe that theme of silence will be one to show up in my next newsletter, since it's something I've been thinking about lately, and it did surface. Silence surfaced in the course of this conversation. In case you were curious, it is called The Redo, and it's the writing I actually do, and I put it out on a monthly basis for free. You can sign up for it at my website, michellerado.com. Again, remember to hit follow in your Apple Podcast, Spotify app, whatever app you may use to get your podcasts, so that these monthly Daring to Tell episodes will pop into your queue on the first Thursday of every month. Thank you again to Nancy Collins for her reading and conversation on The Perfectly Imperfect Potter. My ongoing thanks to Mr. Phil Rado for our theme music, Make Me Brave, as well as occasional rotating closing pieces, like today when I think I'm going to pick out this song because it's something that's been in my head a lot lately. It's called Sugar from the Tree. Most of all, my thanks to you, since you are still here at the very end of this episode and have most intrepidly dared to listen. I will catch you next month.
I've been gone so long now, not sure where I've been. It was a long way around, I can't remember now. It's been a long, long
sun come back again. Where do you think I've been? I've been gone a long time. And one day I will melt into this big bad world. One day I will be sugar from the tree. I used to laugh at outlaws. I wondered why they strayed. But sometimes I choose to listen to what they say. It's been a long, long day. The sun is heading down again. I wonder where I've been. I've been gone a long time. One day I will be sugar from the tree.